Tonight's reading is from Genesis chapter 3, verse 8 to Genesis chapter 4, verse 8. You find it on page 3 of the church Bibles. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man and said to him, "Where are you?" And he said, "I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself." He said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" The man said, "The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me the fruit of the tree, and I ate." Then the Lord God said to the woman, "What is this that you have done?" The woman said, "The serpent deceived me, and I ate." The Lord God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and above all beasts of the field. On your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." To the woman he said, "I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." And to Adam he said, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. And you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return." The man called his wife's name Eve, because she was the mother of all living. And the Lord God made for Adam and for his wife garments of skins and clothed them. Then the Lord God said, "Behold, the man has become like one of us in knowing good and evil. Now, lest he reach out his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever." Therefore the Lord God sent him out from the Garden of Eden to work the ground from which he was taken. He drove out the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden he placed a cherubim and a flaming sword that turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life. Now Adam knew Eve his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, "I have produced a man with the help of the Lord." And again she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it." Cain spoke to Abel, his brother, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him.
Thank you, Sabine, very much for reading that. Please do keep that open. A special welcome if you're here for the first time. Great to have you with us. And Happy New Year to those of you who are celebrating Chinese New Year tomorrow. If you are here for the first time, there's a little outline of where we're going on the white sheet inside your service sheet. You may find that helpful. Well, the woman had booked what seemed to be the dream holiday in Spain. The images in the brochure looked absolutely amazing. So a beautiful apartment overlooking the sea in this little quiet coastal village. When she got there, she discovered there was a building site right next door. And she found herself on the phone every day to the apartment owner discussing the varying decibels of hammering and trying to negotiate compensation. In addition, it turned out that the people next door were smokers, and their apartment balconies were so close together that the neighbours could actually see into their own apartment, into their apartment when they're out on their balcony having a smoke. The reality was a far cry from the images in the glossy brochure. Now, I hope you haven't had that experience with your holidays. You may have had, but I hope you haven't. But you may well have had that experience with your work. That is to say that in the first sermon in Genesis 1 and 2, we looked at God's good creation design for work. We saw that we were made in God's image to rejoice in relationship with our Creator. And we were made to rule the world under Him. And we saw that work was one expression of this God-given rule. And so I take it that Adam would have woken up every morning rejoicing in the Lord. I take it he would have leapt out of bed on a Monday morning and would have been sort of punching the air, excited about, you know, the prospect of another week to serve the Lord in the work of the garden that he's given me to do. And work would have been pure joy for that guy. Is that your experience of work? Idyllic brochure, but the reality of work now doesn't quite match that, and you don't need me to tell you that we live in a fallen world. And so we need not just to understand what God's good design was, but also how the fall has affected our work. And it's important to follow this, because otherwise we may have unrealistic expectations of work, and we may feel, if we're Christian people, that we may feel we're doing something wrong. Because, you know, we're finding work hard going. And so the point of this study is to see how work has been affected by the fall. And to do that, we're going to look at a number of passages in Genesis. And so here are six perspectives on work in a fallen world. And we'll move through them fairly rapidly. So firstly, then, work has become painful occupation. So if you turn back to Genesis 3. In Genesis 3, when God judged the man for his sin, his work was directly affected. So 3:17, God said, "Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread." Work became painful toil. His job was to work and keep the garden, but now the ground is cursed, and thorns and thistles grow, and work becomes hard sweat. In a fallen world, work is jolly hard. I mean, do you find you leap out of bed on a Monday morning, punching the air, shouting, "Yippee, you know, off to work again, another week"? Sanyan was sharing last week in, I think it was the second service, when he was being interviewed, about his work in IT. And he was sharing how you could spend months and months working on an IT project, and then the budget gets pulled, and it's all for nothing. You know, work has plenty of frustration. Things go wrong. It's hard to get things done in the time available. That's stressful. Rather than work being an area of life in which we are constantly expressing our God-given rule, we may now often feel that we are being ruled by work and overwhelmed by the pressures of work. And that will be true even for the Christian. So the person who's being restored in the image of the perfect man and ruler, Jesus Christ. And so, yes, we can and we should serve God in our work. And yes, we can find satisfaction in a job well done. But in a fallen world, work is also going to be painful occupation. In Genesis 1 and 2, we saw that there was work not just of the garden, but work of the home. So we looked at the gift of marriage and children. But this work of the home also becomes painful in a fallen world. So in verse 16 of chapter 3, you'll see that it says, "To the woman God said, 'I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children.'" So God's judgment fell also on the woman in her area of work. So bringing children into the world would now be fraught with pain. And bringing them up would also be a painful experience too. So not just a delight, but also exhausting and discouraging and full of heartache, as sometimes children don't turn out as you would want. Just think of Cain and Abel. Think of the heartache that they brought to their parents. And the whole project of cultivating a marriage would become as hard as cultivating the ground. So in verse 16, God said, "Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." Speaking about the battle of the sexes. So as Christians, work is going to be a bittersweet experience. God's good design that we saw in Genesis 1 and 2, that isn't ripped up and discarded, but it is messed up and distorted. And so as Christians, we are to serve God in the work of the garden and the work of the home. And we may find joy, we may find satisfaction in that, but there's also going to be pain and difficulty. And seeing this can free us from this added burden of guilt. You know, thinking, well, I shouldn't be finding things so hard as a Christian. And so if you're struggling at the moment with how hard working life is, in the office, at school, at home, and this is telling you that you're not odd, you're not spiritually mature, it is hard, and we need to look to God for help and to one another for support. Second factor is fatal conclusion. So verse 19 says, "By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you are taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return." Death entered the world. Another part of God's judgment on human rebellion, that the man would now return to the ground in death. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. So made to rule the earth, made to work the ground, but now each of us will one day be ruled over by the ground. And we'll be swallowed up by the ground as our dead bodies are lowered one day in a coffin or a casket. And that fatal conclusion to our lives, it affects our work. It overshadows our work. It stamps on our work a futility which wasn't there in the Genesis 1 and 2 brochure. It's something of which the writer of Ecclesiastes was keenly aware. For example, Ecclesiastes 1 verse 2, he says, "All is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever." What do we gain? You know, what is the ultimate point of the work that we do? It seems so meaningless in the face of death. I mean, you know, you slog away for 40 years or whatever in your particular job, but for what? Yeah, the work that we do, it can seem so important at the time, and we get so stressed out about it, but does it ultimately matter? So just think of that software you're developing at the moment, those cases that you're working on, the deals that you've sorted out, that subject that you're teaching at school. When you're old and you're facing death one day and you're looking back, how important will all that work actually seem then? In Greek mythology, there was a guy called Sisyphus who was someone who was condemned by the gods to forever roll a boulder up a mountain, only to see it roll back down again. And on it went. And there's something of that in our work now, in the face of death. Another day, another dollar. Same task again and again. As soon as you empty the inbox or the in tray, it refills. Another meal to make, another nappy to change. And ultimately, what is the point of it all? You know, will it actually matter? What will it matter when you're dead? Now, I don't know if you feel this in your work. I felt it very strongly when I was teaching French and German in a school. Many of the kids weren't in the least bit interested. They couldn't see the point. And I could sympathise with them to some extent. You know, so what if they can now order a beer in German? Most of them were never going to go to Germany in their lives. You know, when I was working in a bank and I was looking after the money of people who had much more money than they needed anyway, you know, what does it matter in the face of death? Their death and mine. The death factor, it does affect our work even as Christians. We are living and we are working in a creation that has been subjected to futility and bondage to decay. That's Romans 8:20. And so work is always going to have now this sense of futility somewhere in the background. But we still need to do it. And as Christians, we are to do it for the Lord, and we are to do it to serve Him. We are to be godly in our work. We are to give ourselves as well to the work of the Lord, as we were seeing last week, this work of building His church, a work which we know will not be in vain. Third dimension now is sinful relations. If you flick over to chapter 6, verse 5. Chapter 6, verse 5, we read this. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. In a fallen world, the heart of the human problem is the problem of the human heart. Our hearts are sinful and they're rebellious. And that corruption within is worked out in our relationships. So back in chapter 4, verse 8, which we had read, Cain rises up against his brother Abel, and he kills him, the first murder. Why did he do it? It's because of what was in his heart. Anger in Cain's heart spilled over into murder of his brother. And later in that same chapter, in chapter 4, verse 23, we read of a guy called Lamech. And Lamech says, I've killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. And he actually boasts about it in a poem or a song. The sin in our hearts affects our relationships with others. And that is something else which can make working life very difficult. I mean, just think of the gossip, the slander at work, the rivalry, the envy, the selfishness, the unkindness, the harassment. I mean, if I ask you, what do you find the hardest thing about your work? Would it be something about the work itself? Or would it maybe be relationships at work? Now, I don't know, you may have fantastic colleagues, but sin as it is expressed in relationships can be a huge source of stress at work. Office politics. I mean, just think of that for a moment. People manipulating other people to get what they want. And I don't know, sometimes there may be a particular relationship at work which causes you no end of grief. So there may be someone who just seems to have it in for you. And there may be someone you just don't get on with. There may be someone you just dread bumping into because it's so awkward. Now, these sinful relations at work, they affect work not just at the individual level, but also sometimes at the corporate level. So do you remember the late Steve Jobs saying that he wanted to destroy Android? And he said that he would spend all of Apple's money and his dying breath if that is what it took to do so. Basically, he regarded Android as a stolen product, and he was filled with animosity. Now, if he was right about Android being a stolen product, then we see sin there, don't we, in that relation, that someone was stealing someone else's idea, but then also in his response, in wanting to destroy them for it. Now, this sin factor is not going to go away in our working life. And if we're Christians, it will affect us too, because this is the world in which we work. And let's face it, we will see these things in our own hearts as well. But as God's people, it also gives us a wonderful opportunity to be different. Godliness stands out in that sort of environment. And so the people that we are at work and the way we relate at work is supremely important. So it actually matters more than the actual work that we do. Because the project we're working on, in the end, that may be for nothing. The budget may get pulled. But what will endure is how we've done the work and how we've related to others at work. Number four is godless ambition. If you flick over to Genesis 11... So in Genesis 11, this well-known incident, we find humans working together on this really impressive project. So verse 3 says, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. And then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. So there's this development in technology as people figure out how to make bricks, and then they figure out how to put these bricks together and make a city, and then how to make a tall tower. You know, it's no mean feat. It's impressive. But look at how verse 4 goes on. Let us build a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves. It's very striking, isn't it? No concern with God's name. It's all about making a name for themselves. And this ambition to build a tower which has got its top in the heavens, it suggests not the desire to get to God, but the desire to replace God. So they're not trying to get to God, they're trying to replace God. We will ascend to the heavens. We will be God. And so in a fallen world, work can become an expression of proud rebellion against God. You know, look at what I can do. Look at what I have achieved. I don't need God. I am God. Work, achievements at work. It's made people think that we as a race have no need for God. Now, this idea of, you know, look at what man can do. We can put people on the moon. We can split the atom. We can do anything. Man, the measure of all things. And at the individual level, achievements at work can make people feel that they don't need God. You know, look at what I've achieved, my education, my qualifications, my position. Now, once we leave God out of the picture, what happens is that this tower-building project becomes a new centre of life, replaces God. So instead of living for him, people live for work, and that becomes the integrating centre of life. So it's what they look to for meaning and for purpose and for a sense of worth. Now, what God thinks of that, we see in verse 8. It says, so the Lord God dispersed them from there over all the face of the earth, and they left off building the city. So in God's judgment, there is a breakdown of community, as people are scattered and their languages are confused. But having been scattered, what actually happens then? Do people just give up building towers now? Well, no, I take it that presumably, after this point, you just had lots and lots of individuals going off, trying to build their own little towers somewhere, no longer working together, but each seeking to make a name for themselves. And isn't that what you see in so much of working life today? Even in the work of the Lord? You know, people building their own little tower to make a name for themselves. So not working to serve God, not working to serve others, but working to serve themselves. Working for their own glory and reputation, and promotion. Doing whatever it takes, maybe, to get to the top. Prepared to sacrifice anything. Principles, family, in their lust for power and recognition and wealth. Driven, perhaps, by this ambition to make their tower, their little empire, a bit taller than the next person's. In fact, Ecclesiastes 4, verse 4 says, very strikingly, it says, then I saw that all toil and all skill in work come from man's envy of his neighbour. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Just want my tower to be a bit bigger than the next person's. Now, this godless ambition in the workplace, it can make it a very difficult environment. Say, if people are committed to making a name for themselves and building their own tower, their own little empire, then you've got rivalry. If people have made work the centre of their life, replacing God, they are going to have very different priorities to you as a Christian. And they simply won't understand it when you as a Christian turn around and you say, look, I've got to go now. Yeah, I'm leaving. I've got to go now because I've got other things in my life which are important, which are even more important. Yeah, I've got a church family that needs me. I've got a different building project, as we saw last week, which is even more important to me. I've got a growth group that I need to get to. I've got a spouse. I've got kids, perhaps, who need me. I'm not living for work. Yeah, I'm living for God. Now, people whose life is centered on work, for whom that is the integrating center, they are going to think that you're mad. They're going to think that you've lost the plot. And it may mean that others get promoted instead of you. Now, as Christians, we also need to beware letting this same godless ambition creep up on us. We are to work to serve God. We are not to work to make a name for ourselves, and we're not to work to replace him with work as the centre. Number five is unfair conditions. And if you turn on to Genesis 31, we'll just spend a moment on Jacob. So Jacob's working experience with Laban makes for pretty sobering reading. So Genesis 31 verse 40. Looking back on his working life, Jacob says, "There I was. By day the heat consumed me, and the cold by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I've been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flocks, and you've changed my wages 10 times. That was working life for Jacob. It's pretty hard going, looking after Laban's flocks, sweltering in the day, freezing by night, and repeatedly cheated by his employer who kept changing his wages. And yet, this guy Jacob, he'd been a man of integrity. Working life in a fallen world, it can be very unfair. And God's people are not exempt from this. And you may have experienced this at the sharp end. So you may have an unfair boss. A boss who doesn't appreciate the work you do. A boss who takes credit for it. A boss who makes unreasonable demands on you. And Jacob could say, well, been there, got the T-shirt. 20 years of that is a long time. How on earth how do you keep going as a man or a woman of God in that sort of situation? Well, he tells us in verse 42 how he kept going. He says, "If the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac, had not been on my side, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. But God saw my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night." So Jacob kept going because he trusted that the Lord was on his side. And so if you're being unfairly treated at work at the moment, that is the thing to hold on to. The fact that God knows and God sees and he's on your side. He's not forgotten you. You may be unfairly treated at work in particular because you are a Christian. That was Joseph's experience. So later in Genesis in chapter 39, when you read the story of Joseph, you may remember that he was a man of God, he was a man of integrity. And because of that, he resisted the advances of his boss's wife, who was repeatedly trying to seduce him. And the boss's wife retaliates by falsely accusing him. He loses his job, he winds up in prison. It can be costly making a stand for God in the workplace. It can be really costly. But we are to do it knowing that God is with us. And that ultimately, as we do this, we follow in the footsteps of Christ himself. So in 1 Peter 2, Peter picks up on exactly this situation, writing to Christian slaves. In 1 Peter 2:20, he says this, "If when you do good and you suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you are called, because Christ also suffered for you." So he's saying Christ suffered unjustly. Christ didn't retaliate, but as verse 23 goes on, it says he continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. And so Peter concludes in 1 Peter 4:19 with this. He says, "Let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good." And so if you're being unfairly treated at work at the moment, that can be a huge stress, it can be a huge burden to carry, but know that you're in good company. Jacob, Joseph, Jesus, don't become bitter, don't become resentful. Do tell Christian friends so they can support you and pray for you and encourage you to keep entrusting yourself to the God who judges justly. Well, the final piece in this Genesis jigsaw of work in a fallen world is bitter oppression. And if you turn back to Genesis 15:13 for a moment. Genesis 15 verse 13. The Lord tells Abraham what lies ahead for the people of God. He says, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants or slaves there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years." God's people would become slaves in Egypt. And if we just sneak over into Exodus, we get an idea of what working life was like for them in Egypt. So if you go over to Exodus 1:13, and we'll have a slide up in a moment. That's Jim's cue. Exodus 1:13, it says, "So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves." Working life for God's people in Egypt was a nightmare. Yeah, they were enslaved by ruthless masters who made their lives bitter. And we need to acknowledge that in a fallen world, work is that bad for some people. It really is. There are people who are exploited by ruthless taskmasters. They're working in appalling conditions, doing long hours for pitiful pay, and they've got no way out. So work for them is a million miles removed from the picture in the glossy brochure in Genesis 1 and 2. It really is the holiday from hell scenario. And it puts any hardships we may have in our work in perspective. The picture on the screen is quite a famous one, I'm sure you've seen before, by Sebastian Salgado, of workers in a gold mine in Brazil. And I've no idea what conditions were actually like for those workers, but from that picture it doesn't look a picnic. It looks pretty hard going. And just imagine for a moment if that was your work, your daily work. It is for many people around the world today. I mean, just think of those working in sweatshops year in, year out. And it's not just in other countries. In the book, Not on the Label, you can read about the working conditions in the food and the agriculture industry here in the UK. That here in the UK, we've got tens of thousands of people, mostly foreign, often employed illegally, who are working for ruthless gangmasters in food factories, living in Dickensian conditions, and subject to violence to enforce the regime. In places like Cambridgeshire, you know, an hour up the M11. In one case, the employer had provided accommodation for the workers in partitioned containers that had no water supply. Rent and transport costs were deducted from their weekly pay. And get this, one person was paid £83.85 for a week's work, and they were charged £80 for rent. You've got citizens' advice bureaus around the country that have apparently catalogued a huge number of cases like this. Now, in New Testament times, James wrote about this sort of bitter oppression. We saw this in the James series, that in James 5, verse 4, he says to the oppressors, "Behold the wages of the labourers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you. And the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts." The Lord hears the cries of the oppressed, and he is coming in judgment on their oppressors. And to God's people who are suffering that sort of oppression, James urges them to be patient until the coming of the Lord. But there is also a case for Christians to actually work to secure justice now for those who are oppressed in their work. To do what Psalm 82 verse 3 talks about when it says, "Maintain the rights of the poor and the oppressed." I've mentioned before Lord Shaftesbury, who in the 19th century, he dedicated his life to relieving the suffering of millions in their work in Victorian England. It's because of Shaftesbury that women and children were finally excluded from the horror of working in the coal mines. It was because of Shaftesbury that factory working hours were limited to 10 hours a day. It's because of Shaftesbury and his hard work on behalf of the climbing boys, these boys who were sent naked up the chimneys by sweeps. And he often paid for their release, and he prosecuted brutal masters at his own expense. And finally, in 1875, he managed to steer a bill through Parliament to put an end to this evil practice. And so there's maybe something there for Christians to do to relieve the oppression of some people in the workplace. So work is not bad. Work was ordained by God before the fall. Work is still part of God's good design. It's part of how we are to serve God in this world. But this world is now a fallen world. And because of that, work is fraught with all sorts of challenges and hardships. And so as Christians, when we find enjoyment and we find satisfaction in work, that is something to give thanks to God for. It's a wonderful gift. And when we're finding work hard, we need to keep doing it for Him. We need to pray hard. We need to persevere. We need to keep trusting. We need to be godly. We need to support one another. And we need to look to the world to come. Because in the age to come, God promises in Isaiah 65:22, He promises that then my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labour in vain. But in this age, work is going to be this bittersweet experience. And if you're not yet a Christian, it may well be that you can relate to that incident of the Tower of Babel. It may be that work has become the centre of your life in place of God. So it is to your work that you look now for meaning and for purpose. Well, that is driving a 10-ton truck over a 1-ton bridge. Work cannot support that sort of weight. It was never designed to. And that is a life out of line with reality and under God's judgment. God is the centre of the universe, and He needs to be the centre of our lives. And so even today, God calls us to reorder our lives around Him, to trust in Him, to live for Him, and to look to Him and His work in creation and salvation. We're going to take a moment for quiet reflection and prayer. And then when the music starts, we're going to stand and sing the next two songs together. And the first is a song of recommitment in which we lay everything before the Lord. And in particular, it's an opportunity in song to lay our working lives before the Lord as a living sacrifice and to say, take my life, take my working life, and I want to live it for you. But first, let's pause and pray.